This is the TechNation podcast from IT Conversations. Johns Hopkins science writer Deborah Rudisill is the author of The Riddle of Gender. I asked her, what's the physiological definition of the human male as well as the human female, and what measurable physiological states lie in between?
Well, I think it's very important to begin by defining a few terms. For example, we use the word sex and gender synonymously these days, and that's sort of a misnomer. They're not exactly the same. When we talk about sex in the context of science, we're not talking about sexual orientation, we're not talking about desire, we're talking about the biological markers of sex. What are they? First, we have chromosomal markers. Most people think you're either XX or XY, but there are people in this world who are XXO, XXY, XYY. So there's variation chromosomally. Another biological marker of sex is gonadal sex. Again, most people think, well, you have testicles or you have ovaries. Well, that's true, but some people have a mix of testicular and ovarian tissue. So again, a little bit of variation there. Endocrine. Males and females produce both androgens and estrogens, but in different balance. What's the balance? Morphological sex, your body shape. How is your fat distributed? Do you have facial hair? Again, variation. Genital sex, you know, people think you have a penis or a vagina. Well, some people have incompletely differentiated sexual organs. And then finally, we get to the really confusing one, gender. Gender identity, your sense of yourself as a male or a female. Increasingly, this is becoming apparent as brain sex. How are you sexed in your brain? So there variation can be introduced at any level. And although in most people, all of these biological markers of sex are congruent, in some cases they're not. And we're learning that in maybe 2.2% of live births, people are intersexed in some way.
Now, intersex is the term you use, I-N-T-E-R-S-E-X,
intersex.
Intersex.
Yes.
And it's some intersection of the two sexes.
Yes, in any one of those ways that we just discussed. For example, XXY people, Klinefelter syndrome, you know, feel male because they have the Y chromosome. Some identify as women, some identify as men. Morphologically, they are male, however.
So this is 2+% of births. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 6 billion people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Quick, let's do some math. Actually, let's do some math.
Yeah, I'm not good at math. You'll have to do the math.
Okay, but 6 billion. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll do this. 6 billion. 2% would be 0.02. So that'd be 6,000 million. So 1% would be 60 million. Okay, so that's 120 million people
mm-hmm.
actually don't fit into the regular categories.
Exactly.
That's not just
it's,
a couple.
It's not a minor number.
Not a minor mm-hmm. number. I should divulge that I have old friends whose child is some 30-plus years old now,
mm-hmm.
and when she/he was mm-hmm. born, she presented both kinds, both she as they
a
said,
clinical
they,
riddle.
Yeah, she had both sets of equipment, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, she's grown up, had mm-hmm. three of her own children biologically,
mm-hmm.
a husband. I mean, you would just
mm-hmm.
never know from that confusing
mm-hmm.
start. What they said is that at the time when they were counseled about this, that the options presented were medieval
yes.
or even cruel.
Yes.
What was the case and what's going on today?
Well, there's been a sea change in the past couple of years. Since the late 1950s, early 1960s, it was thought that it was important when children with anomalous genitalia were born that a decision be made as early as possible as to which sex the child would be assigned. It was considered a medical emergency. And very often, indeed, most always, those children were subject to, quote, normalizing surgeries to normalize their genitalia. And then in puberty were dispensed hormones based upon that original sex of assignment. But when those children grew up, many became activists, intersex activists, and argued that this should never have been done to them without their consent. And increasingly, that view is being adopted within the medical community. There's a wonderful pediatric neurologist named William Reiner, who was originally at Johns Hopkins, now is at the University of Oklahoma, who's done studies of intersex children, which show that with time, they can tell you who they are, and there is no reason to perform surgery prior to the child actually telling you whether they are a boy or a girl. And that view is increasingly being adopted in the medical community. There are still a few holdouts, of course, but things are changing.
It's one thing when you have anomalous equipment, as mm-hmm. my friends would say. Mm-hmm. It's quite another thing if we're talking at the endocrine level or chromosomal level mm-hmm. that you wouldn't naturally test for unless you had a reason to.
Exactly. And very often those situations aren't discovered until much later in life. And these are all – I think it's important to stress that these are naturally occurring conditions. You know, biological variation is part of life on Earth. And In cases like that, very often when it is discovered, there is, again, pressure for the child to be or the young adult to be pushed in one or other directions. But, of course, by then they can tell you who they are. I interviewed some people for the book who, for example, a neuroscientist at Stanford who in late adolescence it was discovered that he, at that point she, had a condition called Müllerian agenesis, absence of vagina and uterus. And as he tells it, the doctors were like, well, you're XX, you're a girl, we're going to construct an artificial vagina for you. And he said, I didn't really want one, but I was never really asked. It was just assumed that because I was chromosomally XX that I would have a vagina. And of course, much later in life, this person who always felt very uncomfortable with a female gender identity decided to transition to male.
And today is a neuroscientist at Stanford.
Yes, brilliant, brilliant guy.
It's one thing to say that Mother Nature, with a roll of the dice, might produce a number of intersex offspring here, mm-hmm. and that's understandable. But now we have some scientific evidence that some of these conditions are a product of that disastrous drug greatly prescribed in the mm-hmm. 1940s to avoid miscarriage, diethylstilbestrol, mm-hmm. DES. What's the evidence? How does it show up, and how strong is that evidence?
Well, it wasn't just prescribed in the 40s. Just to clarify, that it was prescribed in the 40s through the 70s to millions of women in the belief that it would prevent miscarriage. That was later proven to be untrue. Initially, the first effects were seen in the early 1970s. There was a cohort of young women who were being treated at Massachusetts General Hospital, a cluster, who were afflicted with a very rare form of vaginal cancer. And in trying to figure out why this might have happened, one of the moms said, I was treated with DES. Could that have something to do with it? And sure enough, I think of those seven young women, six of them were DES children. So at that point, the FDA contraindicated the use of DES in pregnancy. Well, DES, like most endocrine disruptors, shows delayed effects. So it's only been very recently that we've been starting to see gender variance among DES children. The evidence is very strong in animal research. Dr. John McLaughlin, who's at Tulane University, has been studying DES in various forms of animal life for over 30 years. And it's true that it creates structural and functional abnormalities of the reproductive system in experimental animals. Only very recently has some of that research been applied to human beings, particularly in the area of gender identity. None of the large cohort studies of DES children even ask the question of gender identity. So this is an area of research that needs to be aggressively pursued at this point. I stumbled on this connection when I became aware of an online support group for the XY children of DES mothers, which was started by a social scientist who is himself a DES son. He's not transgender, but he does suffer from hypogonadism, which is testosterone deficiency. And then discussions on the list soon revealed that a number of the list subscribers had lifelong psychosexual issues, and many were transgendered.
How does DES interrupt the endocrine system?
Again, this research is just getting started, but it looks like the mechanism is the WNT4 gene that somehow, through some sort of epigenetic effects, it affects that gene, not in terms of mutating the gene, but in terms of gene expression. And that's an area of research that is being pursued right now, and I'm sure we're going to be learning more about over the next few years. One of the really interesting things that's happened in the last couple of years, previously it was thought that female was the default sex, that without a sharp burst of androgens in the second month of pregnancy, most embryos would develop in the female direction. But now, because of all the new technology, DNA microarrays, we're discovering that an interaction of a number of genes probably begins to sex the brain even before that sharp burst of androgens. So again, we're learning more about this all the time.
Well, in case you thought you were off the hook because your mother was not prescribed DES, there was discovery of DES as in all kinds of applications. Perhaps the most important was in 1947 at the Purdue University Agricultural Research Station, where they noted that DES stimulated growth in cattle. What happened from there?
DES was put in not only cattle feed, but also in feed for other sorts of livestock. Some of that was stopped in the 60s when they started observing pernicious effects in agricultural workers like infertility, gynecomastia, which is breast growth in men. But DES, they didn't stop putting DES in cattle feed until 1979, I think. So even if, you know, this generational cohort was not exposed to DES directly because their mothers were prescribed DES, they received a secondary exposure because of maternal diet. You know, I would say most of our mothers consumed DES-tainted meats during the 40s through the 70s, and that the effects of that secondary exposure right now are not known. But again, I mentioned this, the science of epigenetics, which looks at things like the effects of maternal diet on fetal development, and it's clear that there are effects.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Johns Hopkins science writer Debra Rudisill. You may remember her from her earlier book, The Scalpel and the Butterfly, The Conflict Between Animal Research and Animal Protection. She's back with a challenging subject, the riddle of gender, science, activism, and transgender rights. With a conflicted physiological base or anatomy base, it's no wonder it wouldn't lead to many cases of conflicted gender identity. I mean, who am I? And it has to be, you know, as you're going through puberty and as you're growing up, I mean, these have to be, you're dealing with something that's an anomaly. So we can't say, oh, well, this is how it works in you, or here's the general trend. We don't know. So let's turn now to modern day psychiatry, which is both has a psychological component and behavioral component, as well as a medical and physiological component, and the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. What is the official call of the American Psychiatric Association about people in this middle intersex group?
Well, the DSM these days, and this has only been true since the latest version of the DEM, characterizes this condition that we'll call the brain intersex condition as gender identity disorder. And
that means that your brain thinks one thing, but your body apparently is another.
Exactly. However, the DSM has nothing at all to say about the etiology or the cause of various conditions. And so gender identity disorder has been basically conceived of within the psychiatric community as a psychopathology, which many members of the trans community and an increasing number of doctors and scientists are now starting to contest, because it's becoming increasingly clear that this is physiological. It's not purely psychological. It's not a perversion. It's not a psychopathology. It's based in the body. And many activists are fighting to have gender identity disorder removed from the DSM for that very reason, because they feel that it pathologizes them. On the other hand, as the system is presently constituted, you need a DSM diagnosis in order to have access to hormones and to surgery, which many transsexual people need in order to feel right in their body. So it's a very difficult issue, and probably the best way out will be as when more research reveals the exact mechanisms by which this condition occurs and it's reclassified as perhaps a congenital endocrinological condition.
And condition versus disorder, those are two
words. Yeah, the language is very loaded, and the language remains a problem. One of the things that I looked into when I was doing the book was the history of the word pathology and contrasting it with anomaly, because, of course, pathology implies something wrong, whereas anomaly implies variation. And I'm much more comfortable with anomaly than I am with pathology. As a couple of my sources told me, I'm very uncomfortable with this being viewed as a birth defect because I am not defective. And I thought that was a really nice way of putting it.
Feelings run high on this topic, pro and con, by all sides and its nuances. How would you describe the complete set of activism around these issues?
Well, there's really a broad range. You're talking about activism together with the science, views of science among activists, yeah. There are some activists who very much want to see greater scientific understanding of this issue because they think it will help them gain their civil rights, and I tend to be in agreement with that issue. For example, if you want to make the parallel with homosexuality, it really wasn't until homosexuality was removed from the DSM in 1974 that gay people began making progress toward civil rights. And again, it was a combination of activism and science and having it removed from the DSM. Transgender people are in a little bit of a more problematic position because they do need to interact with medical service providers. So as we were discussing before, removing gender identity disorder from the DSM might have a negative impact in that it would prevent people from getting the access to the services that they need. On the other hand, there is a substantial portion of the community which argues we don't need the doctors, we don't need the psychiatrists, we're not pathological. This should be viewed more as a consumer issue. And if we want access to hormones and surgery, we should be able to get them. So there's a broad range of opinions on this issue within the community, I think. One of the things I discovered when I was doing my research is there's not, strictly speaking, one trans community. There are many communities, and individuals and groups all have different views on this issue.
Within the general insurance company that everyone has to deal with, I'm using that as one big amorphous insurance company because there are many options within that. How is this situation covered? Is it covered at all?
Barely. It's barely reimbursed. I think just in the last year, one big insurance company, I'm thinking that it's Aetna, has agreed to begin reimbursing for hormones and surgery. But to my knowledge, they are one of the only ones who are doing that, and that's very recent. Really, it's been up to the individual person to pay for their hormones and surgery out of pocket. Of course, here in the city of San Francisco, things are a little different because over the past 2 years, the city health plan has begun reimbursing, and that's a step forward.
Where's the science going to go next? What are people looking at?
I would say that next, the most promising science right now, I think, is coming out of Dr. Eric Villain's lab at UCLA because he's the one that's doing the research which shows that there are between 52 and 54 genes active in the brains of male mice being expressed differently in male and female mice even before that surge of estrogens early in pregnancy. And that is really fascinating. And I think as the technology develops and we learn to measure gene expression and to tease out the implications of gene expression, we're going to be learning a lot more about the sexual differentiation of the brain, which is, of course, very controversial, as we've seen, you know, in all this controversy over the Larry Summers comments at Harvard recently, you know, that males and females might simply have different abilities and that it all comes down to the brain. A lot of people don't even want those questions to be asked, much less researched.
If either you suspect that you might fit in this category, mm-hmm. or perhaps one of your offspring you mm-hmm. suspect might fit in this category, mm-hmm. what would you do?
Well, I think those are two different questions. If it were myself, I think I would do what most of my sources have done, which is basically struggle with the issue for a number of years and try to achieve some degree of self-understanding. And then I think it really depends where you fall on that gender spectrum, whether or not you choose to have hormones and or surgery. An increasing number of young people these days are choosing not to alter their bodies at all, although they are living in the opposite gendered role. In the case of your child, I think that the most important thing is acceptance of the child for who they are and not trying to force them into one of the two socially acceptable boxes, and that becomes very difficult not within the home so much as in the community. Trans kids are often brutally mistreated in their schools. They're harassed by their peers. Very often their teachers are not terribly understanding. So you want to protect your child and support your child at the same time that you let your child be him or herself. And it's a tough road. I think that we are seeing increasing acceptance and tolerance, but it's certainly not widespread at this point.
I can't imagine going to the family doctor and saying, golly, can you check me out? What would you do if you wanted the medical establishment to at least say, hey, you're in balance here, you're in balance here, you're in balance here. Oh, well, actually, this is not in balance over there. Who would you go to?
I think I would probably see – you have to see a therapist first in order to get the reference to an endocrinologist usually. But I would go to see an endocrinologist if this were my situation. And not any endocrinologist will do. You have to find someone who is well-versed in these issues. And to be honest, the medical community needs education just as much as the public does. Now, these days there are people who specialize in gender identity disorders, therapists, endocrinologists. They do have the base of knowledge, but you have to seek them out more now than in the past, I would say.
You are listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Johns Hopkins science writer Deborah Rudisill about the 120 million humans who are scientifically speaking intersexed, who are not definitionally female or male. Since the subtitle to her book is Science, Activism, and Transgender Rights, I asked about the rights of transgender people.
Well, actually, transgender people have their rights taken away from them in a number of different ways in our society today. For example, I'm sure you're very familiar with the concept of cities and states passing legislation protecting people on the basis of sexual orientation, protecting them from things like job discrimination, housing discrimination, being harassed in the workplace and stores. But far fewer cities have passed legislation protecting people on the basis of their gender expression. And so very often people don't have any recourse when they are discriminated against. I note in the book of the case of Peter Euler, who was a truck driver for the Winn-Dixie supermarket chain in Louisiana. He was basically fired from his job when his employers discovered that he was a cross-dresser. He was not negligent in his duties in any way. He was not cross-dressing at work. But when he was asked, he admitted honestly that he did occasionally cross-dress. Interestingly, the question was asked because there was a rumor that he was gay. And his supervisor said, "Are you gay?" He said, "No, but I do occasionally cross-dress." So he was fired. All of his benefits were terminated. His wife, I think, is diabetic, so they really needed their health insurance. And the case was brought to the courts in Louisiana, and his claims of damages were denied because transgendered people are not protected under existing legislation. So it's very important that that change.
Well, this has been terrific, Deborah. Thanks for joining me. Please come back again.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today is Johns Hopkins science writer Deborah Rudisill. Her book is The Riddle of Gender, Science, Activism, and Transgender Rights. It's published by Pantheon. You've been listening to Tech Nation, podcast from IT Conversations. For more information, visit our websites at technation.com and itconversations.com. I'm Moira Gunn. Thanks for listening.